hit it big, selling her gothic artwork on Etsy for a living. "So?" she says, head tilted to the side as she raises a black penciled brow, needling me with her emerald green gaze. "What's up?" "Oh, you know," I bite my lip thoughtfully. I'm not really prepared to spill any details about Lair yet. I'm still feeling overwhelmed and speechless about the whole business partners thing. "Just the usual, what's going on with you?" We both sit down on the edge of the bed and take slices out of the box of pizza, making twin sounds of contentment as we relish the gooey cheese. "Well, I'm ridiculously stoked about the music festival tomorrow night," says Sharon around another huge bite. "Marcus is going with me, as are all of the roomies. We picked up our tickets the minute they went on sale." She pinches a long string of cheese stretched between her mouth and the slice and gobbles it up with a satisfied smile, just like she used to when we were kids. "I've been planning my outfit for weeks. I got these sickening fishnet arm warmers from the Alternative Arts and Crafts Fair. Hand crocheted. Can't wait to show them to you." She pauses, lips pursed, and gives me a sidelong glance. "What are you wearing?" I shrug, and immediately Sharon casts her eyes to the black-painted ceiling, despairing over her big sister's non-existent fashion sense. "Come on, this event isn't exactly my scene. I mean, I don't have any fishnet arm warmers, hand-crocheted or otherwise," I tease her. But Sharon is already standing up, her half-eaten slice flung to the lid of the open pizza box. She opens her closet doors with a dramatic sweep of her arms and pulls a series of very black clothes off of very black hangers. Then she wordlessly tosses the dark bundle at me. "Sharon, this really..." I hold up a short black skirt, a zippered black tank top, and a pair of black fishnet tights. "Isn't me." It is a truth universally acknowledged that music festivals provide a prime opportunity to show off, to dress up, Sharon tells me with a wheedling smile. "No fair bringing a literary reference into this. You know that's my weakness." "Seriously, Court, just give the outfit a shot. You can wear boring bookstore clothes if you want to, but you'll stand out like a sore librarian." "Hey, I resemble that remark." I laugh, folding the clothes neatly before grabbing another slice of pizza. "God, this is so good." "Food of the gods." She falls back onto the bed beside me with an oof. From the common room downstairs, there's a sudden, muffled outbreak of laughter. "It seems like there are more people here than usual. Have you signed on some new roommates?" I ask curiously. Sharon shakes her head, picking up her discarded piece of pizza. "No, most of the people downstairs are part of Vamp Watch. You know, the Vampire Neighborhood Watch. Remember I mentioned them to you before?" I nod, thinking as I chew. "Yeah, I remember." According to Sharon, Vamp Watch is the most outspoken group of pro-vampire advocates in Cincinnati. She and Marcus are active members. "Well, anyway, we just had a meeting and it got pretty intense, so now everyone's chilling, playing video games, and goofing around to take the edge off." I stiffen slightly. "Oh? What was the meeting about?" "Working out a plan to combat Drew Yarrow," my sister mutters, her eyes green slits, and her disgusting hate group sang. "Right. That's what I was afraid you were going to say." "What?" Sharon pauses mid-bite to blink at me, confused. "What do you mean that's what..." "Look." I sigh for a long moment. My sister continues to stare at me as if I've grown a second head. Frowning, I drop my pizza slice into the box. I've suddenly lost my appetite. "I've got something to tell you." Sharon leans toward me, brow furrowed. "What's wrong, Court?" she asks gently. I fret at the edge of the paper napkin in my lap, feeling the pain that I've purposely pushed down, ignored, well up inside of my chest, my throat. I straighten my spine, gaze mournfully into my sister's shining eyes. "I think Mia is involved with Drew." "Drew?" Sharon shakes her head, as if waiting for me to say something more. Then understanding dawns over her face, and she shakes her head harder. "No, you mean no. Drew Yarrow? That Drew?" "Yeah, that Drew." Sharon gapes. "I mean, I don't know for certain if they're having an affair," I say, raking a hand back through my tangles with a heavy sigh. "Mia has been, I don't know, interviewing Drew or something, following her around to get a story for her paper, or so she's told me. But I saw this picture of them together, a photo of Mia demonstrating with Sang." I trail off. My eyes are stinging and I sag on the bed, sunken down by the weight of the matter. "I just don't know who she is anymore." "Oh, Court." Sharon places a hand on my shoulder and squeezes. I smile at her weakly. It's okay. Really, I mean, it hurts to realize you've misjudged someone so much, but the truth of the matter is that I want to break up with Mia. I've wanted to for a while. There's always been something missing in our relationship, you know? Sharon watches me sympathetically. I breathe out. When I told Mia that I thought we should go our separate ways, though, she asked for another chance, and I couldn't deny her that. She said she was sorry. She seemed sincere, but I swallow and bite my lip. But, my sister prompts me, staring very intently at my face. I stop tearing the napkin and draw in another deep gulp of air. But the thing is, I say softly, quietly, I'm attracted to someone else. My sister begins to smile, but to her credit, she forcibly flattens her mouth, trying to maintain the straightest expression possible. She holds her tongue, simply raises her eyebrows and waits for me to go on. I'm attracted, I tell her, knowing that my next words are going to overwhelm her oh-so-fake appearance of composure, to the vampire who moved in next door. Sharon squeals, launching herself forward and wrapping her arms tightly around my neck. Didn't I tell you that Mia was bad news from the moment I met her? She sits back, her black painted fingernails curled around my shoulders. I mean, God, she's such a wet mop. Point her in the direction of a pretty woman and she'll follow that tail like a bloodhound on a scent. She makes a little gasp and covers her mouth with her hand. God, I'm sorry. Too soon? Now's not the time, I know. She gives me another quick hug before peering keenly into my eyes. Seriously, though, I need details. A vampire? I feel it fair to warn you, sis, she begins with a cheeky smile, that once you go fangs, you never go— God, Sharon, it's not like that, I tell her miserably, burying my face in my hands. I can feel the all-too-familiar blush creeping over my cheeks. Details, Courtney. You can't drop a bombshell like, I'm attracted to a vampire, and then just leave me hanging. I won't, calm down. Inquiring minds want to know. Okay, I begin, sighing as I try to piece together a chain of inarticulate emotions. How do I describe Lair? How do I explain how her voice, her eyes, her nearness affects me? I can't, not to my little sister, not now. It's all too new, too soft and unformed, too raw. I decide to stick to the facts. Her name is Lair, Valeria, and she's a scientist at Give Life Technologies. A scientist vampire, Sharon informs me helpfully, holding up her index finger, is super hot. I roll my eyes at her, even as I silently agree. She has a Saint Bernard. She's possibly French, and that's about all I have to tell you. I tug at an errant knot in my hair. It's just a crush. I'd never cheat on Mia, I say firmly. Of course not. I never thought you would. Sharon arches one brow as she watches me carefully. I know you better than that. Thanks. She shrugs, then crosses her legs on the bed with a wicked smile. I can't lie, though. I'm really happy that you're thinking of splitting up with Mia. She's been bad news from the start, you know? I was shocked when you introduced me to her. She's so flighty. She never struck me as the type of person Courtney Banks, perfectionist, could fall in love with. My lips part, and we both stare at one another for a long moment. What? What did I say? Sharon asks nervously. You look sick. Was it the pizza? Do you need to throw up? Well, while my soul is already bare. Sharon? I start, voice hushed, my mouth dry as ash. I didn't even know if I believe in love. I mean, love, falling in love, true love, soulmates, that kind of stuff. My sister watches me unblinking, stunned or bored, it's hard to tell. I sigh. You are right there with me, Cher, I tell her hoarsely, flicking my gaze to my hands in my lap. Our parents fought like cats and dogs. No, I reconsider, twisting my mouth to one side. They fought like rabid cats and dogs. They fought about everything, the bookstore, us, they fought about dinner. They were the most incompatible people in the world, and that's what I see over and over again. I see incompatible people coming together and just hurting each other. It's this vicious cycle that no one else seems to notice. Sharon remains still and quiet as I stand up, tossing my torn napkin into her silver skull-embossed trash can. I smooth my hands over my skirt, shaking my head as I turn back to her. My throat is tight. You know I enjoy reading love stories like Jane Eyre. It's my favorite book. But I mean, I love reading ghost stories too, and that doesn't mean I believe in ghosts. I've been in enough relationships to wonder, I breathe, if maybe love is only a work of fiction after all. Sharon opens her mouth, is about to say something, but then there's a soft rap at the partially shut bedroom door. Hey, I just wanted to see how you guys are doing. Can I come in, or are you ladies dishing about the latest RuPaul's Drag Race? If you are, spoilers, because I haven't seen the episode yet. Marcus grins companionably, peering around the edge of the door. Sharon and I laugh, grateful for the break in the tension. Then, like a black leather-clad gazelle, Sharon leaps from the bed and springs to the door, reaching out for her boyfriend's hand. Come on in, snooper. Sorry. Marcus ducks into the room with an apologetic shrug, a dimpled smile adorning his boyishly handsome face. He gathers Sharon into his arms, and the intimate act comes so naturally, as if Sharon is an extension of his own body. He leans down and kisses my sister deeply, but somehow softly. She sighs against him. As a couple, they've never been shy about public displays of affection. And yeah, the love Marcus and Sharon share is unquestioningly real. They've been together for 5 years and just got engaged last spring, though they claim that they knew from their very first date that they were destined to marry one another. They've been saving up for the whole length of their relationship to finance the nuptials of their gothic dreams, a destination wedding in, where else? Transylvania. They intend to promise their undying love in the place that, mythically at least, the undead call home. After smacking lips in another passionate kiss, Marcus and Sharon draw apart, and Sharon taps his chin with her finger and says, "We'll be right down, okay?" Marcus nods, baring his vampire teeth as he grins at me. "No rush. Come on down when you're done gabbing, and we can all watch the episode together. The Vamp Watch crew is going home, so now it's just me and the roomies playing Mario Kart." He offers us a small salute before turning on his heel to disappear down the hallway. Sharon pushes the door closed, then stretches out her arm to tug at my hand. "Look, Court," she tells me gently, squeezing my fingers. "Think about what Dad always used to tell us when we came to him for advice. You remember, right?" My throat tightens, but I nod, whisper, "If you were reading the story of your life, what would you want you, the heroine, to do right now?" Sharon and I stare at one another for a long moment as my pulse begins to accelerate. The thing is, before I even spoke those words, a well-worn litany that formed on my lips as easily as the Pledge of Allegiance, I knew my answer. I could never bring myself to say it out loud, but it's there, and so obvious it hurts. Even if nothing ever happens between myself and Lair, my relationship with Mia has been in its death throes for weeks, if not months, and it's harmful to both of us to be half of a failing relationship. We're not right for each other. I thought I was in love with her, or deluded myself into thinking that I was, that I must be, but I wasn't. I'm not. Mia deserves someone who can love her for who she is, for everything that she is, with an unwavering constancy, an unshakable certainty. I'm not that person. I can't do that for her, and I don't think she can do that for me. It's over. I gasp, caving inward, and am only vaguely aware of Sharon's arms wrapped around me. I feel as if I've just been thwacked in the chest with one of those anvils that always appear in old school cartoons. But even as the resolve hardens inside of me to break up with Mia tonight, I remember the hurt look on her face when I attempted to break up with her a couple days ago, how the tears stood shining in her eyes. God, I can't handle that expression again. Not yet. Just think about it, says Sharon quietly, watching me. I shake my head, suddenly exhausted. Hey, could you tell Marcus that I'm sorry I can't, that it's just been... With a heavy sigh, I stand up and lean against the ornate dresser. Its surface is decorated with framed photographs of Sharon and Marcus, laughing, kissing, sharing a candy apple at the state fair. I stare at the pictures dully. I think I'm going to go home, go to bed early. I'm just drained. Sharon springs up beside me and gives me a tight hug. Don't forget these. She shoves the pile of black clothes into my arms. Outside of the old fire station, a humid summer rain is beginning to fall in large, heavy drops. I run toward my car, but the deluge soaks me through before I reach it. Through my damp, dripping lashes, the whole world looks as if it's been painted watercolor gray. Chapter 6. Love and Hate. My fantasy of escaping to the misty moors of Jane Eyre while soaking in a hot, sudsy bubble bath evaporates the moment I pull into my driveway. I lean forward over the wheel, watching my house's blurry silhouette through the raindrops spattering on the windshield. Something feels wrong. Maybe I'm just projecting or absorbing the gloomy atmosphere. Dark storm clouds are hanging over the edge of the horizon, and the rain is falling silently, steadily. With an unaccountable dread, I slump out of Colonel Mustard and shut the car door. It thuds dully, and the rain thuds dully, too, on the top of my head. Thud, thud, thud. My feet feel heavier and heavier with each step, as if they're urging me to stop, turn around, go back. Just as I'm putting my key into the lock, the front door of my house opens beneath my hand, and Mia's standing on the other side. I freeze. Mia? I wouldn't be more shocked if a ghost suddenly materialized before me. Mia is the last person I expected to see right here, right now. The last person I wanted to see, given my state of mind. She stares at me with wide, dark eyes, surrounded by darker circles. Hi, she says shortly, stepping back and gesturing toward the room behind her. Come on in. What are you doing here? My voice is icier than I intended, icier than I feel. I mean, your car isn't in the driveway. How did you... I begin, but Mia shakes her head, moves further back into the shadows of the house. She looks agitated, haunted. Her long brown hair is drawn up into a messy bun. She's usually neat, even vain about her physical appearance. And I've never seen her wear a collared, button-down shirt before. This one is oversized and the sleeves are rolled up to her elbows. The sight reminds me of those girls in high school who strutted through the hallway wearing their boyfriend's too big varsity jackets. I draw in a deep breath, and my stomach churns inside of me as I wonder, how can I help but wonder, if the shirt Mia is wearing belongs to Drew Yarrow. She doesn't kiss me, greet me, doesn't speak at all. Impatient, she grabs my arm, and instead of pulling me into the house, she yanks me back outside, beneath the silvery pouring rain. And her gaze is pointed very, well, pointedly, toward Lair's house. Oh, God. I wrap my arms around my middle and bow my head, bracing myself. Raindrops slide over the bridge of my nose and drip from the tip of it, plinking softly to the ground below. Cold water streams over my lowered lids. Do you know who's living next door to you? Mia asks, voice knife sharp. She's staring at me now, her eyes wide, wild, and growing wider and wilder as she waits for me to answer. I stand my ground, lift my chin, my own words colder than the iceberg that sank the Titanic and with the same cutting edge. Yes, I know Valeria Mael. She's a customer of mine. A customer? Okay, I expected Mia to be pissed, given her new anti-vampire lifestyle, but I didn't expect her to explode. Are you kidding me, Courtney? She snarls, her narrow face paling as her lips draw back to reveal a row of very white, very human teeth. She's a monster, and you're saying she bought books from you? That you let her come into your shop? How could you allow that thing to get anywhere near you and your employees? As I gape at her in horror, stunned to silence, her face smooths. The lines on her forehead are gone. The frown is replaced with a neutral curve. This instant calm seems even more unsettling than her angry outburst. I take a step back. Listen to me, Courtney. Her tone is low, even sinister. I've never heard Mia speak this way before or look this way, so tense, as if she's on the verge of violence. You can't associate with her anymore. You can't, in any way. It's as simple as that, she says firmly, darkly, her eyes flashing with an unfamiliar light. You can't be linked to the vampire agenda. I remain still, wordless for several seconds. The ground feels as if it's tilting beneath my feet, as if it might give way at any moment. I press fingers to my temple and force out, Did you honestly just say vampire agenda? My body has gone cold. Disbelieving, I grit my teeth together, stare hard into her unflinching eyes. Tell me, Mia, I say, unable to keep the bitterness out of my voice. Are those Drew's exact words, or did you do a little creative revision of your own? Mia snarls again, actually snarls, and moves nearer, her hands curling into fists at her sides. We stand before one another, facing off, and I can't think, can't react, can't do anything but marvel over this change, this metamorphosis. Mia is acting like a completely different person, like a junkie in need of a fix. I don't know who she is. She's a stranger. My girlfriend has become a stranger to me. My mind whirls and my heart stutters in my chest, but I refuse to back down. I won't look away. And finally, Mia relents, because that's what Mia does. Her yielding gives me a small flare of hope, not for our relationship, but for Mia's well-being. A portion of the old Mia is still inside of her, though Drew has worked something supernatural, reinventing her in such a short amount of time. I watch mutely as Mia turns on her heel and, with an exaggerated sigh, marches back into my house. I follow her to my kitchen where she grabs her purse off of the counter and stomps toward me with a huff. "We're done," Mia snaps, inches away from my face. Then, without another word, she runs back outside. "Wait!" Groaning in frustration, I follow her into the rain again. The storm is at its peak, with wind rattling through the gutters. "Mia! Look, I didn't come here to argue. I just wanted to give you these." She digs around in her purse for a moment. Then she pulls out a large stack of papers. "Glossy brochures. I thought you could put them out with the free newspapers in your bookstore." I almost take the stack from her, simply to put an end to this painful encounter, but then I realize what the brochures are, and my arm recoils. Sang flyers. She's shoving sang flyers at me, and in clear view of Lair's house. "The enemy is very real and all around us," is printed in bold typeface on the front of the flyers, along with a purposefully insulting photograph of a man wearing white face paint. Blood dribbles over his chin from comically oversized fangs. I can't hide my disgust. Still, Mia wags the brochures at me, urging me to take them, despite the fact that they're now floppy and soaked. I try to keep my voice steady as I say in a clear, tight voice, "I will never distribute Sang literature in my bookstore. Sang is a hate group. Mia, I think you've been brainwashed." "Brainwashed?" She stares at me with saucer-wide eyes, deeply startled, as if I've just announced the impossible, that I'm from the planet Neptune, or that I suddenly realized I'm straight. "They haven't brainwashed me," she says, with a small laugh of conviction. "God, if anything, they've opened my eyes." Her cheeks are pale and her hair is drenched. I notice now, too, that she appears as if she's lost some weight. She looks like a ghost of her former self. "Courtney, Billy was killed by a vampire. You know that." "Billy?" I breathe out. Billy was Mia's brother. 2 years ago, he walked into a convenience store at the wrong time during a robbery, and he was shot and killed by a perpetrator who turned out to be a vampire. I inhale and exhale several times, gathering my thoughts and softening my tone. "Mia, your brother was killed by a criminal. I'm sorry for your loss. You know I am. I know you and Billy were close. But isn't it very obvious to you that you can't blame all vampires for the actions of a single one? You can't be this narrow-minded." I squeeze my eyes shut as Mia's face begins to crumple. I want to reach for her, comfort her, but she feels so far away from me, worlds away. "Mia," I continue quietly, I'm sorry Billy died, but you have to realize that the vampire who killed him doesn't represent every vampire or any vampire. He and he alone was responsible for his actions. A tear streaks down Mia's face, disappearing in the rain, and she sighs, draws back her shoulders, and curtly nods her head. "Drew told me you would say that," she whispers, eyes shining with a gleam that makes me reflexively shiver. "Last night, when she and I were talking," I wince at her emphasis of the word, "she told me that you wouldn't understand, that I shouldn't even try to explain anything to you. But I'm not going to give up, Courtney," says Mia, her eyes still fervent, afire. "I want you to see the truth. I want us to be together in this, because it's right, Courtney. I swear to you, it is." She claims my hand with her cold, clammy fingers, but I slip free from her and draw away. No. My heart aches in time with the thunderclap cracking overhead. We will never agree about this. But no, Mia. She stares at me through the rain, her lips softly parted, her gaze dimming as their hopeful shine, moment by moment, fades. There's nothing left for either of us to say. I gulp down a breath of cold air, turn around slowly, and walking back toward my house. I don't expect her to call out for me, and she doesn't. Sodden and miserable, I walk through the front door, shutting it and locking it behind me. There's the sound of a car swishing up to the curb a few minutes later, and when I draw back the curtain to look out through the window, Mia is gone. It's been a slow week, and a difficult one. I haven't heard from Mia since our awful conversation in the rain. I keep replaying the scene, hearing her insist upon a vampire agenda while pointing at the house next door like the judge probably pointed at the unfairly accused women of Salem. I can't bring myself to call Mia after what happened. We left things on such bad terms and at an impasse. The second chance she asked of me seems to have fizzled out, officially expired. God, I hate loose ends. I hate doors left open to invite in more upset and pain. I have to contact her. I have to officially break up with her. But when is the right time? And how can I drum up the fortitude to do it when my heart is already shattered? Finally, it's Friday morning, and I've never been more grateful for the end of a work week in my life. I stand behind the counter in the shop, taking a sip from my to-go coffee cup as I juggle my cell, calling up Mia's number and then chickening out, again, before I can force myself to press send. I wince a little as hot liquid burns my mouth. The phone clatters out of my hand, sliding onto a pile of mail. At the same moment, the store telephone begins to ring. For a nerve-wracking moment, I think it must be Mia calling. But then David ducks his head out of the back office doorway. Courtney, there's someone named Gustav on the phone for you. He holds up the cordless. Didn't say what he was calling about. I put down my coffee and wave my hand in front of my mouth, eyes watering as I accept the receiver from him. Thanks, David, I say around my burnt tongue, and then I blink a dozen times and clear my throat. Hello? Professor? I say into the phone. Miss Banks. His accent is thick, German, and his voice is deep. Apologies for my delayed response, but I would be very pleased to send that book to you. You will wire the money, yes? Yes, yes, I will, thank you. I hop onto my stool and open up the laptop. Did you send me the information I need to wire payment to you? It is coming to your email, even as we speak, he says. I can hear the smile in his voice. I was very interested as to why your client would desire such a book, Miss Banks, I must confess. He harumphs for a moment. I am an expert on alchemical texts, you see, and Maximinus' work is not well known, though it was revolutionary for his time and, quite frankly, still is. I log into my email account and scan for the message from Gustav. It's there, right between an email from Azure about the concert and a spam email alerting me to the presence of sexy, naughty, hot, single local guys. He was a revolutionary? How so? I ask absent-mindedly as I scribble notes onto a legal pad. Well, Maximinus was attempting to create a substance that looked, behaved, and even tasted like blood, without using animal or human materials. I drop my pen, heart pounding. A blood substitute. Hold on a second. I swallow and shift the phone to my other ear. You mean this guy was trying to make blood that wasn't actually blood? Simply put, yes, says Gustav, with an almost audible shrug. Or so his biographers claim. There are detailed descriptions in the book, actually, about his scientific methods. Apparently, he had some success in his endeavor, but no one, to my knowledge, has attempted his experiments since. I listen, rapt, my mind racing. The successful creation of synthetic blood would, well, it would change the world. On top of revolutionizing the medical industry, it would rewrite the futures of human and vampire kind. My arms are covered in goosebumps. I'm playing the middleman to history here. My voice sounds excited, wired, when I say, I'll get back to my client right away with the information you sent me. I should expect the wire transfer to occur today. My client is very eager to get this book in her hands, so I hope that you'll be able to ship it quickly.
Wonderful, wonderful. I will do this.
Gustav chuckles softly.
It was a pleasure, Miss Banks. A pleasure.
And, just like that, the line goes dead. I'm too stunned for extended small talk right now anyway. I grip the counter, stare down at the wire transfer details I scribbled onto the notepad. If Lair could do this, if she could really do this impossible thing, vampires wouldn't have to drink real blood anymore. The taboo would be irrelevant, eradicated. And if it wasn't real blood they were drinking, well then, wouldn't vampires be just like us? Living creatures who must ingest specific nutrients to survive? The senseless hatred would have to stop, or lessen significantly as the differences between us decreased. Wouldn't it? I shake my head, pick up my cell phone and the legal pad, angling toward the back office. David is done filing in there and is now whistling somewhere between the shelves of the shop. I need to speak with Lair right away. I dial her number, excited about the book, but also truthfully excited for this excuse to speak with her again. We haven't talked since our lunch date. She's busy with her work at the lab, and she is understandably stressed out over the kidnappings. As much as I've longed to call her and see her, I've resisted the urge to initiate contact, because I don't want to further complicate her life by entangling her in my complicated life. And honestly, I was reluctant to talk to her again before I'd broken up with Mia. There's just something about Lair, and something about me when I'm around Lair. I wanted to have a clear conscience the next time we spoke. No guilt, no self-imposed restrictions. But unfortunately, I'm a shaking in my boots coward, and am still, technically, in a relationship with Mia. Lair answers on the second ring.
Courtney.
Her voice is tired but warm. I can hear her smiling against the phone.
How are you?
I smile too, feeling a hot rush move through my limbs and flush my cheeks.
I'm doing well,
I tell her. I'm doing well now, I think. Listen, Gustav just called me. Finally, I have the wire transfer information.
Oh, magnifique,
she says, and then she takes down the details as I relay them. But she seems distant, distracted. I can hear background voices on the end of her line as if there are multiple people in the room with her. Maybe I interrupted her during a meeting. After Lair takes down the final number from me, she says quickly,
Just one moment, please.
More muffled talking while I wait, tapping my pen on the legal pad anxiously.
Courtney,
says Lair at last. Her voice sounds different now. More relaxed, open, and the other voices are gone.
Are you still there?
I'm here.
Sorry, I had to move to a different room. I am really so glad that you called.
Her tone is soft, velvety, but then she sighs, a weary sigh as if she's bone-deep exhausted.
It has been a terrible week, ma belle. So, so terrible. Ma belle.
My high school French is rusty, but I can guess at her meaning. A delicious shiver courses through my veins. Focus, Courtney. I narrow my brows and shake my head. What's happened? What's wrong? Are you okay?
Another of my co-workers has gone missing, she tells me tiredly. That makes three, and everyone at GLT is afraid they will be next.
Oh my God, I whisper. I'm so sorry. My stomach twists as I bite my lip. Do you think you're in danger?
At this point, says Lair, her voice quiet, subdued. The targeted victims have been human, but the circumstances are odd. No ransoms have been requested, which makes it all the more puzzling. I am friends with the latest victim's wife, so I'm about to leave work to spend the day with her, to try to console her if I can.
God, Lair. My lungs feel as if they're being pinched. Every breath takes a concerted effort. I wish I had words of comfort to offer. I wish I could think of some way to help. I can't imagine what Lair and her co-workers must be going through. I am certain that if the employees at Banks Books started disappearing, I would be a wreck, a disaster. I would be useless and petrified with fear. The fact that Lair is still functioning astounds me. Admittedly, there isn't anything about Lair that fails to astound me.
On an unrelated note, she begins, a small ray of brightness edging her tone. I would like to see you tonight, if you're available.
Open-mouthed, I pause, computing her carefully chosen words. I would like to see you tonight, if you're available.
Lair wants to see me. Really see me.
This isn't an apology like our impromptu lunch date or a freak coincidence like her bandaging my knife wound during the storm. This is different. Something new.
Yeah, you should really think it over. I'm not sure I'll be great company.
She laughs self-deprecatingly. I glance at the calendar tacked to the wall as I tap my fingers on the desk. The music festival is tonight. Mia and I had planned to go to it together, but after our argument and this subsequent stalemate, I don't expect her to show up for the concert. She never wanted to go in the first place. She was only placating me. Still, I can't invite Lair to be my date. I sigh, trying vainly to untangle my thoughts. I feel as if my head is full of knots. My hair actually is full of knots. I rake a hand back through it, grimacing and chewing on my bottom lip. There's this music festival going on tonight. It's called Vampire Rock Fest, imaginatively enough. A portion of the ticket proceeds goes toward funding vampire awareness, and my best friend is performing. I'm babbling now, so I shake my head, cut to the chase. It'll be fun, I say weakly. And I think you should check it out. Asher, that's my friend. Her music is great.
Oh, well, thank you for the recommendation, Courtney.
There are other voices talking in the background on her end of the line again. I can make out something about investigation and get to the bottom of this. Lair's tone is detached, formal, but regretful as she says,
I hope that I'll see you later.
I hope so, too. I start, but the dial tone interrupts me. Lair is already hung up. That was abrupt. I sigh heavily, staring at the disconnected phone in my hand. After a few moments, I wander out of the office and see David sweeping the floor for the third time today. I'm about to tell him he can go home early. It's been a slow, customerless afternoon when I step alongside the counter and notice his backpack lying on the floor. More specifically, I notice the Sang brochure sticking out of the front pocket of his backpack. Immediately, my eyes flick up to David, watching him as he sweeps non-existent dust bunnies and whistles that slick, too catchy tune. I'd like to believe someone shoved the brochure into his hands, that he didn't read it, that he meant to throw it out, that he's not allied with a hate group. But I don't know what to believe about anyone anymore. Chapter 7. Vampire Kiss. I stare at my reflection in the mirror, tugging at various hems uncomfortably. With my blonde hair and skin-tight black clothes, I feel like Sandy after her cool girl transformation at the end of Grease. Except that Sandy really was cool, and I'm just faking it, wearing my cool little sister's borrowed clothes. I haven't worn a skirt this short since I was in elementary school, and I've never worn fishnet stockings in my life. The zippered tank top is sexy, but so form-fitting that I feel as if I'm laced into a corset. Seriously, are clothes supposed to hurt? Doesn't matter. I'm running late, and I'm out of options. With a shallow sigh, I dig around in the back of my closet and drag out an old shoebox, a souvenir from my grunge phase. Smiling wistfully, I blow the dust off of the lid and open the box up. Inside, there they are, my black military-style boots bought from an army surplus store for $10 when I was in 11th grade. I sit down on the edge of the bed and pull on the boots, lacing them up tightly over the fishnet stockings. When I stand up, the boot heels make satisfying clumps on my bedroom floorboards. Back in front of the mirror, I pull at my hair, drawing it up into a high ponytail and tucking an errant curl behind my right ear. I apply some dark eye makeup, along with a little lip gloss and a spritz of my favorite perfume, a musky scent called Rendezvous. The woman who stares back at me from the glass is unfamiliar, a stranger, though her gestures perfectly mirror my own. Is that really me? I shake my head at my reflection, heart beating too fast. I feel strange, like I'm playing dress-up. Surely everyone will see the bookworm hiding behind this goth Cinderella makeover. I glance at the alarm clock on my nightstand and swear. Azure's performing early in the set, and according to her text, she's scheduled to go on stage in about 40 minutes. I'll be lucky to find a parking space in 40 minutes, let alone run to the venue in time to catch her whole show. "Be good, Colette," I tell my cat, patting her fluffy head as she stares up at me with wide, unblinking, judgmental eyes, as if to say, "You're really going out of the house in that? Really?" I grab my purse and keys and lock the front door on my way out. The sunset in the west is throwing a gorgeous shade of purple onto the clouds overhead. Tearing my eyes from the sky, I fall into my car, jam the key into the ignition, and turn it. And nothing happens. No sputter, no shutter, nothing. Oh, no, 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 no. Come on, you hunk of junk, not tonight. I try the key again, and again, no luck. My car is as silent as a toy matchbox. Oh, no, 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 I whisper, pressing my forehead to the steering wheel. Think, Courtney. Nearly everybody I know is at the concert. It's unlikely that any of them would hear my SOS phone call over the blare of live music. As a last-ditch effort, I shove the key into the ignition again. This time, the engine sounds as if it's being crushed by a trash compactor, and the screech of metal on metal makes my ears ring. I bang my fists on the steering wheel with a growl of frustration. Then, "We've got to stop meeting like this," comes a soft, velvety voice just beyond my open car window. Lair. And when I shift my gaze, when I see her silver eyes flashing, her full lips curving, and her sweet, enormous dog pushing his nose over the edge of the door, trying and succeeding to lick me with his long pink tongue, my tension melts away, replaced by something else, something much more pleasant, a liquid rush of warmth, peace, calm. God, I'm happy to see her. Just another day in paradise. I sit back and offer her a wry smile. How are you doing, Lair? I'm very glad to run into you, she says, her voice a low purr of satisfaction as she plants her hands on her hips and flicks her mirrored gaze to my steering wheel. This guy giving you trouble again? She pats the side mirror and lifts a brow. A lot of trouble. I sigh, then toss my keys into my purse. I was about to leave for the concert, but the engine refuses to start. Staring toward the offending hood, I bite my lip. It kind of sounds like it's about to self-destruct. Well, one might suggest that our meeting here and now was fate, then. Lair tugs Van Helsing away from the door as I open it and step out. The fluffy beast bounds forward, shoving his nose under my hand, licking my wrist. I chuckle, ruffling the fur behind his floppy white ears. I breathe out and glance up, meeting Lair's shining eyes. The sun has sunk below the horizon, so the sky has darkened to charcoal gray above our heads. We're standing between street lamps in shadows, but somehow her eyes still seem to glow. Fate? I ask in a small voice. Well, I was finishing up Helly's walk and was about to get ready myself. You mean, oui? I planned on attending the concert, too. I could use the distraction. Her eyes, bright just a moment ago, now look haunted. Hunted. I swallow. Is everything all right? Ah. Lair blinks, shakes her head, tussling her coppery hair over her shoulders. She refocuses her stare, lingering over my lips. It would be a pleasure to drive you to the concert, ma belle. As she gazes at me, her eyes soften again, and the worry lines creasing her forehead begin to fade away. Would you like that? To go with me? Yes, I really would. Thank you, Lair, I say quietly, holding her rapt, steady gaze. I'm nervous, unsure of what to do with my hands, so I keep petting Helly's head and ears, and he leans hard against me, his tail thwacking the backs of my fishnet-clad legs. Well, good. Lair's smile is a sunrise. It makes me feel new and warm down to my very last atom. Then that's settled. She turns, hugging Helly behind her on his leash. Come in with me while I get ready, Courtney. I won't take more than a moment, I promise. I walk alongside Lair to the front door of her house, holding tightly to my purse strap, my boots clunking over the stones. With a barely suppressed shudder, I remember the sight of Mia standing in my front yard, stabbing an angry finger toward this house, ordering me to avoid all contact with Lair. Lair's car had been in the driveway then, but it was raining, pouring. Surely she hadn't seen, hadn't heard. I hope.
It was a humiliating scene, yes, but more importantly than that, it was motivated by a brand of blind hatred that shakes my flimsy faith in the human race. A hatred that could have deeply hurt Lair. A hatred that destroyed once and for all my relationship with Mia. Lair holds her front door open for me, and I duck my head as I cross over the threshold, feeling Lair's warm presence at my back. She unclips Van Helsing's leash and sets the great animal free. He turns around immediately and sits down in front of me, in the narrow hallway, tongue lolling out of his mouth. I have no choice but to pay his toll, petting him to persuade him to let me pass. He gazes up at me with big brown, adoring eyes. What a good boy! At my words, he begins to pant, the perfect picture of canine contentment. Stop flirting with our guest, Helly. Lair laughs softly. To me, she says, come in, please, and make yourself comfortable. She aims toward a room branching off from the main hallway, gesturing for me to follow. I inch around Van Helsing with a chuckle, tracing Lair's footsteps. But when I pause in the doorway, my mouth goes dry. This room... it's Lair's bedroom. I should have realized it was her bedroom, but my mind is operating at about 10% reliability, and if my brain were a computer, its screen would be frozen right now. Time to reboot. I try to shove my hands into my pockets, but of course Sharon's miniskirt doesn't have pockets, so I cross my arms over my stomach and glance around the space self-consciously. It's a spare but elegant room. Lovely, really. There's a tea-colored lace coverlet on the bed, and the walls are painted a soothing pale shade of lavender. On top of the antique dresser sits a full-bloomed orchid in a painted Spanish pot. The orchid's flowers are such a soft, dreamy hue of purple that they take my breath away. A grow light is positioned just above the pot, and the light filtering through the petals makes them look as if they're glowing from within. They're so beautiful. But my eyes are drawn as if by gravity to a much more beautiful sight. Lair stands beside her bed, and with startling casualness, she peels off her lacy blue tank top, revealing the blush pink satin bra underneath. I hold my breath, stunned. Time stands still. Motionless, I stare at her. I can't stop staring at her. And my heart knocks against my ribs as she turns away from me, unhooking the clasp on her tight black pants and pulling them down over her hips, shimmying her long legs free. Just give me a minute to get dressed, Lair says, smiling sweetly, and not at all shyly at me over her bare shoulder. You can sit down on the bed if you like. I lick my lips and consider sitting, but find I can't quite convince my muscles to move. Every part of me is focused on her, on Lair. The soft slopes of her arms, the hourglass curves at her waist, the lean planes of her smooth, toned thighs, the way that her curls drift over her back, casting shadowy tendrils on her faintly pink skin. The room is dim, the blinds drawn, the only illumination cast by the grow light on the dresser. But when Lair turns again, lips parted as if she's about to say something to me, a strange expression flickers over her face, and her eyes trail my length, slowly, languorously taking in my appearance, and my uncomfortable, embarrassing concert-going clothes. Wow, she breathes, her French accent thick, her eyes dark and wide. I hear her draw in a breath and then let it out in a quiet sigh. Courtney, she turns to face me fully, sharp teeth visible between her parted lips. Beneath her gaze, I don't blush. I burn. Lair, standing so strong, so sure, in only a bra and panties, rakes her gaze over me again, looking surprised, amazed, as if I'm the one who just undressed in front of her. She's staring at me with longing, just as I'm staring at her. We watch one another, the warm air sizzling alive between us as I take in a deep breath, as I rock back on my heels, trying to lock my knees to prevent myself from collapsing to the floor. This is too much, too intense. Beneath the heat of her gaze, something hatches inside of me, something bursting to life, vital and thriving. It's want, want like I've never felt it before. Lair licks her lips.
You look beautiful, Courtney, she tells me,
her voice soft and low, her eyes glinting with silver shards. I laugh self-consciously, shaking my head, even as my full-length blush deepens. This is my sister's style, not mine. I glance down at myself and lift my shoulders in a dismissive shrug. Sharon didn't want me to embarrass her at the concert, so she forced me to borrow her clothes. My lips twist to one side in a pained smile.
The outfit suits you.
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment. Lair's shimmering gaze lingers over me for a moment longer. My heart thunders wildly within me, its rhythm a stampede. I feel exposed, but more than that, I feel seen, as if those shifting silver-blue eyes can take in more than my surfaces, as if they can penetrate me to my deepest core. After a slow, suspended moment, Lair turns away from me, almost regretfully.
I just need to change. One moment.
Her words are a near whisper. With silent footsteps, she moves into her ensuite bathroom and closes the door. My knees feel so wobbly, so weak that all I want to do is sink down onto the edge of the bed. But that seems impossible now, inconceivable. I can't sit on Lair's bed where she sleeps, dreams. I'm already so bewitched. Under her heated gaze, I had begun to forget everything. I had begun to forget that Mia and I haven't officially broken up. I had begun to forget that I have principles. I have never cheated on anyone in my life, and I'm not going to start now, even if my girlfriend is cheating on me. But when Lair steps out of the bathroom, my tenuous grasp on my principles begins to loosen again. I feel like a kid desperately trying to catch the kite string that slipped out of her fingers, and as more and more time passes, the kite grows smaller and smaller against the sky. Lair is wearing a fitted black button-down shirt and skinny black jeans that taper at the ankles. Every hard line and muscle, every soft curve, is outlined, emphasized by her outfit. Her red hair spills over her shoulders in shining waves, and her eyes are outlined in thin sweeps of black. She looks sexy, confident, mysterious, like a rock star. A vampire rock star. So, Lair smiles at me disarmingly, lifting her chin as she steps forward, her eyes flashing with a sharp, dangerous glint of desire. My gaze fastens to her white, pointed teeth.
What do you think?
She asks me simply, spreading her arms wide before positioning her hands on her hips.
Will this do for the concert?
Yes, I tell her, mouth dry. Yeah, I mean, you look amazing.
Merci.
If circumstances were different, if there were no Mia between us, and if I were brave enough, daring enough, reckless enough, I would push Lair down on the bed right now. I would climb on top of her, claim her mouth, her neck, taste her, learn her, but I can't do that. I shouldn't even be thinking about doing that. I fist my hands at my sides and swallow. Then I offer Lair a wavering smile. My friend Azure, I force out. She's going to go on stage soon, in about 30 minutes or so. If you don't mind, we should get on the road. Lair lets out a small sigh, but she nods vaguely and straightens her back.
Yes, of course. Yes, we must go.
She agrees quietly, sweeping a black clutch purse off of the bed and leading the way as we wend through the house and aim for the front door. She pats Helly's head and then slides her feet into a pair of knee-high, skin-tight boots before we go outside together. Her car, two-door, violet, European, is sleek and expensive, in comical contrast to my mustard-yellow clunker in the neighboring driveway. I gaze at Colonel Mustard forlornly. I suppose I should be grateful to that infuriating lemon, because if he hadn't refused to cooperate, I would have never experienced these sensual minutes with Lair. I wouldn't be sharing a car ride with her now. I glance sidelong at my elegant companion, with her lustrous waves draping like satin against her cheek, with her lean silhouette clad all in black. And something in me rises. Something forceful, determined, new. Lair clicks the unlock button on her key ring, and I step forward, sweeping open her driver's side door, feeling like a tuxedoed male lead in an old black-and-white movie. I'm tempted to say something cliché like, "M'lady," or "after you," but I'm too nervous to speak. All of my energy is focused on maintaining some, admittedly small, semblance of coolness. so I hold my tongue as I hold the door, tilting my head with an impish smile and a raised brow, urging her with a nod of my head to climb inside of the car. But Lair doesn't climb inside, and she doesn't return my smile. She meets my gaze with desire in her eyes. Bare, hot, piercing desire. For me. She moves, leans forward, her hip now pressed against my hip, and for a still, sacred moment, I think, fear, hope, believe that she's going to close the distance between us and kiss me. But instead, she tears her eyes from mine and slides into the driver's seat, averting her gaze to the view through the windshield.
Thank you, says Lair, her voice low, husky.
Dazed, I close the door gently and walk around to the other side of the car, feeling hot and ashamed. What the hell am I doing? Flirting. I'm flirting, and I've got to stop. It's time for some evasive action. How is everyone at work coping with the kidnappings? I ask her, effectively killing the mood, once I've joined her in the car and fastened my seatbelt. Lair shakes her head as she turns on the engine. It purrs obediently, like a well-behaved engine should.
We've heard nothing. No news, she says,
anguish softening her voice.
It has been so difficult, Courtney. Everyone goes about their daily tasks, but there is so much fear.
Her face hardens as she pulls out onto the road.
Still, we must prevail. We must. The work we are doing is too important, and everyone knows this, which is why we continue on day and night as if nothing has happened. We keep glancing over our shoulders, wondering, she says, wincing, voice raw, who will be next?
Lair, I'm so sorry. I reach across the space between us and place my hand on her denim-clad leg. A reassuring gesture, nothing more, performed out of mindless habit. I've done the same thing to Azure and Sharon countless times in the past when they were in need of comfort. But the moment my palm connects with Lair's thigh, a jolt of electricity lances my fingers, like a static shock gone nuclear, and I realize my mistake, a mistake that for some reason I can't correct. I feel as if there's a magnet locking my palm to her leg. Lair pulls to a stop at the approaching red light, and she licks her lips and, very deliberately, turns her head to look at me. That's all she does. Looks at me. But a rush of desire burns through my veins. So sudden, so hot, I feel as if my blood is boiling. The light turns green and Lair's foot remains on the brake, and my hand remains on her thigh.
The light's changed, I tell her softly.
Oh? She blinks several times as if she's coming out of a trance. Then she gazes up at the streetlight and presses down on the gas pedal, silent, propelling the car onward toward our destination. I feel the muscles of her leg moving beneath my palm, and it's too intimate, too close. So I draw my hand back and face forward, arms crossed tightly over my stomach. The concert is at the Edge Dome, a sprawling music venue that used to be home to the local orchestra before they were shut down due to low attendance. Now the arena, in an unfortunate twist of irony, is dedicated to local rock concerts and touring performances of big-name music stars. The dome is situated at the very edge of the city, which gave it its name, and allows it to offer a lot of parking space to its ticket holders. The parking attendant, wearing a fluorescent yellow vest, stands at the entrance of the huge lot, waving people in with an orange handheld flag. After driving past several packed aisles of bumper-to-bumper cars, Lair finds an empty space, swings into it, and we both hurriedly climb out, our boot heels clicking on the blacktop. I draw a deep breath of night air into my lungs. The temperature cooled considerably during our drive, and that coolness brings me back to myself, clears my head, helps me focus. You still have a girlfriend, I remind myself miserably, repeating the words in my head like a mantra as I glare toward the bright lights of the arena. Apparently, the universe is compelled to remind me of my coupledom as well, because Mia is waiting for me at the gate leading into the dome. I see her, and I feel the whole world fall away. I'm floating like a soap bubble, weightless, and at any moment I might pop. No, this doesn't seem real. This can't be happening. I don't want this. I don't want a confrontation. Not now, not tonight. But there's going to be a confrontation as soon as Mia catches a glimpse of the woman beside me. I could never forgive myself if Mia said something to wound Lair. Lair, who's walking blithely at my side, unaware of my inner implosion. I glance at her and she smiles softly, excitement sparkling in her silver-blue eyes. She looks so beautiful, so eager, and so deservedly relaxed. No, I won't let Mia hurt Lair, not ever.
I can wait for you here, Lair. My voice sounds high, strained. Why don't you go buy your ticket?
I gesture toward the ticket counter to our left. But already, it's too late. I feel it, this sinking sensation in my stomach. Before I see it, Mia peering through the crowd with her wide brown eyes spotting us, both of us.
What are you doing?
Mia shouts, her rage audible even over the boom of the music vibrating from within the dome.
Oh my God,
I whisper, and Lair glances at me worriedly.
What's wrong, Courtney?
She asks in her soft, smooth French accent. I can't reply, can't shift my gaze. Mia stalks toward us stiffly, anger making her face pale to a corpse's pallor. Reflexively, I step in front of Lair. I can feel my own anger rising, can taste its bile in my throat.
Lair, I whisper through gritted teeth, please go buy your ticket, okay?
Lair's shimmering eyes narrow as she glances from me to Mia, who's making a beeline toward us, her fists balled, her brows narrowed darkly as she stomps, stomps, stomps her high-heeled boots.
Are you all right, Courtney?
Lair asks quietly.
Yes, I mean, no, but...
I sigh, shaking my head, gaze still fixed on Mia's white, furious face.
Can you, give us a moment?
I shift my eyes to Lair, beseeching her, and she nods hesitantly, flicking her silver, flashing gaze to Mia once more before stepping away, angling toward the ticket counter with her hands shoved deep into her jeans pockets.
Okay, Mia, you need to calm down,
I whisper when Mia stops in front of me, eyes wild and nostrils flaring. She stares at me, chest rising and falling in a long, deep breath. When she speaks at last, her voice is sharp, curt.
I was supposed to come here with you, remember? We had a date.
Lips curled up in a smirk, she makes a show of taking in my appearance, flicking her eyes over my length with a raised brow.
What is this? The new Courtney Banks, here with your new girlfriend? Mia, it isn't... Are you sleeping with her?
She snaps, so loudly that Lair and the dozen people surrounding us could have easily heard her, though they are all too polite or too distracted by the music to glance our way.
Look at you, all dressed up like a pretty goth princess.
Mia crosses her arms as she rakes her eyes over me again, sneering.
Have you turned into a vampire groupie?
You're one to talk about groupies, I reply coldly. You've become Drew Yarrow's sycophant. As Mia takes a step back, hurt brightening her shadowed eyes, she lifts her chin and bares her neck, which I can't help but notice is covered in love bites. Hickeys. Hickeys that I certainly didn't give her. They almost look like bruises. My heart somersaults in my chest, but I gulp down my pain and whisper,
quite a collection you've got there, Mia.
What? Following the direction of my gaze, Mia pales further and ducks her chin back down, awkwardly, drawing up the hem of her t-shirt in a vain attempt to conceal her telltale throat. She shakes her head, eyes slitted furiously.
You know what, Courtney? You don't know anything about Drew and me.
She almost sounds petulant, like a little girl trying to convince her mother that sugar actually is good for her, that she should be allowed to eat an entire birthday cake if that's what she wants to do.
I inhale a shaky breath,
slammed by the realization, in one cold, hopeless moment, that everything that I had imagined Mia and Drew were doing with one another was probably eerily close to the truth.
You're right,
I say hoarsely, my eyes unfocused, my whole body chilled, covered in goosebumps.
I don't know anything about you, Mia. I thought I knew you.
I search her face, trying to find some trace of the woman I once thought I loved. But there's nothing familiar about her. There's nothing for me to hold on to anymore.
Well, people change,
Mia mutters despondently, staring at her shoes. Yeah, I agree, in a stronger, more convicted tone. They do. and I tried to talk to you about this before, Mia. I don't think there's any sense in second or third chances. We've used up all of our chances, both of us. It's time for us to admit to ourselves that we just don't work. We don't fit into one another's lives. There's just... I lift my arms, letting them fall uselessly against my hips. There's just nothing left. Mia's eyes are wide enough to rival the full moon rising above our heads. She takes a step nearer to me, begins to reach for my hand, but stops herself, biting down on her lip. I'm not sleeping with Drew, Courtney, she blurts out defensively. If that's what this is about, don't. Okay, yeah, we've kissed, and we've done a little more than kissing, but just a little, I swear. We haven't just... Stop. My heart aches so sharply that I press my fingers to my chest. We have to just... Stop. I feel so hot. My head is pounding. The lights from the arena are blurs, zigzags of blue and red and green. Please, Courtney, I still love you. I choke out a hoarse laugh. I don't even know what that means, I tell her, tears leaking from the corners of my eyes. And I don't think you know either. We stand in uncomfortable silence for seconds that yawn into minutes. Finally, Mia's phone rings inside of her purse, ding-dinging loudly, startlingly. With a curse, she fishes her cell out of her bag and glances at the illuminated screen. Oh, I have to go. I'll call you. Mia steps forward, tries to wrap her arms around me, tries to bring me close enough to kiss. Her face is tilted up toward mine and her lips are parted, waiting. I take a firm step backward, shaking my head. No, I tell her quietly, my voice thick with sobs. No, we're done, Mia. It's over. Over? My ex-girlfriend's brown eyes flood with tears, and I'm suddenly seized by the urge to hug her, to comfort her, even though I'm the one causing her to feel this pain. But I can't hug her. I can't be soft, vulnerable. I have to break the cycle, or we'll just keep hurting each other over and over again. So I stand my ground, imagining myself a statue, immobile, unfeeling, though I'm acutely aware of the aching cavity in my chest, a black hole where my heart used to beat. And then Mia is shaking her head too, and she whirls around away from me, running off in the direction of the parking lot. I feel as if all of the air has been forced out of my lungs. I start to hyperventilate, bending over at the waist, drawing in deep swallows of cool air. From the corner of my eye, one last hot tear falls, streaking its way over my raw, reddened cheek. And then Lair's there. Lair. I feel her beside me, soundless, wordless. I feel her like warmth, like a guiding star. She curls her long fingers around my elbow, drawing me up and gazing at me with her impossible silver eyes. In the neon glow cast by the stage lights, her eyes look electric, full of glimmering sparks.
I'm sorry, she murmurs,
her voice as soft as her expression. I nod resignedly. You heard.
I heard.
She inhales through her nose, staring intensely into my eyes.
Should I go? Am I complicating things for you?
No, no, I say quickly, raking a tired hand through my hair. None of this has anything to do with you. I breathe in and breathe out and try to smile. It's a weak attempt, but Lair's mouth curves slightly in response, and then I take another deep breath and slip my hand into hers, feeling her warm palm pressed against mine. It's comforting. It feels right. Come on, I sigh. Let's go bang our heads or crowd surf or stand in the back with the other old people and tap our feet, listening politely. Lair's smile widens, and as we face one another, she lifts her hand. Slowly, softly, she wipes the stray tear from my cheek.
You have eyes like forests, Courtney, Lair whispers,
her voice husky, her eyes brimming with something unspoken.
I think you can be wild when you want to be.
Oui? My heart, which only moments ago had felt insubstantial, non-existent, beats triple time in reply to Lair's words. I swallow and then laugh self-deprecatingly. Oh, no, I'm not wild. Unless by wild you mean staying up past 11 on a work night to finish reading Jane Eyre. Lair raises a brow, lowers her voice, and then, as if in a dream, she whispers to me,
Eugene, I must have you for my own. Entirely my own.
I stare at her, lips parted, heart thundering, chest constricted as desire blazes, reborn phoenix-like inside of me. Lair just quoted my favorite line from my favorite book, a line she knew by heart. She smiles disarmingly, tilting her coppery head to one side.
Believe it or not, she says, her brow still raised. I played Mr. Rochester in a stage production of Jane Eyre at my women's college once upon a time.
I was quite fond of the cravat.
Oh.
I'm so surprised, so flustered that I go into robo-Courtney mode, automatically following Lair as we move toward the line and then hand our tickets over to the bouncer at the gate. We make our way through the crowd inside of the dome itself, trying to find, i.e. shove our way into, a place in the audience.
Do you enjoy acting?
I shout to Lair over the music. The floor beneath our feet is shaking. She laughs, bringing her lips close to my ear.
No, but some friends of mine dared me to audition for the part, and I never turned down a dare.
Despite the strobing lights and the ear-splitting music, I pause in the flow of hot, pushing bodies, feeling a time-out-of-time moment as I meet Lair's gaze. She's returning my stare meaningfully, and then she inclines her face toward mine, brushing her mouth against my ear.
I never turned down a dare, she repeats, and I can hear the smile, the dare in her voice, for future reference.
Suddenly, the music that has been booming all around us stops, for a long, drawn-out moment. Someone shouts indecipherable words into a microphone, and then, just as unexpectedly, the music starts up again. But there's a different vibe to the melody, something fresher, wilder. The crowd erupts into frantic, delighted screaming. In all honesty, I'm only peripherally aware of the shifting waves of sound, but I'm all too aware of Lair's nearness, her scent, her thigh hot against mine. We're still holding hands, and every so often, Lair caresses the back of my hand with her thumb, invoking lightning bolts of longing within me. We've positioned ourselves several feet away from the stage, but I recognize Azure the instant she struts out in front of the crowd, purple mohawked and drop-dead gorgeous in a black sequined jumpsuit. And that's when I shake my head, command myself to be here now, to pay attention.
That's her, isn't it?
Lair asks excitedly.
Azure?
I nod my head. Yeah, the acts must be running late. We got here just in time. Lair lifts a brow, whispers,
Fate,
into my ear. And I inhale deeply, staring at my reflection in her mirrored eyes. Azure grabs the microphone with rock star confidence. And when she belts out the first verse of her song, a classic called The Straight White Male's Lament, JKLOL, the concertgoers cheer, jumping up and down and waving their hands above their heads. Caught up in the adrenaline rush, I scream my heart out for Azure as she dances, moonwalks. She tried to teach me how to moonwalk once, and sings until she nearly goes hoarse. She's incredible on stage, charismatic, sexy, funny. As her best friend, I'm biased, granted, but I'm hardly her only fan. There are women throwing phone numbers and bras onto the stage, and a bouncer has to physically restrain a young lady from climbing over the speakers to fling herself at Azure, though she keeps screaming, I love you, even as she's dragged away, upside down. Lair appreciates the music, too. She's bouncing on the balls of her feet, whistling through her fingers. She looks odd, different, and it takes me a moment to realize that she looks different to me because, in this moment at least, she isn't worried about anything. She's simply happy. And she looks radiant when she's happy, like a luminous red-haired angel in a Botticelli painting, no cares in the world. I make a vow then and there to try my best to inspire this state of happiness for her whenever I have the opportunity. The tension that she's been experiencing for the past couple of weeks has taken too high of a toll. After the concert and after we drive to my house, with the explosively loud music still ringing in my ears. Lair eases her car into my driveway, her bumper breaking just behind Colonel Mustard. She leans back in her seat, tilting her head toward me with a warm smile.
Thank you for tonight, Courtney, she says softly, drawing me in with those shining eyes.
I really needed something like that. Her voice is hoarse. I shake my head with a small smile. Don't thank me. I needed it too. I lick my lips as I hold Lair's gaze. One of her arms is pillowed beneath her head, and her stare smolders as she regards me indulgently, lazily, her eyes raking over my length with slow, bare appreciation. Maybe I'm still hyped up on the energy of the concert. Maybe the now-confirmed fact that Mia cheated on me has finally sunk in, settled like an old rubber boot on the bottom of the sea, and ceased kicking me in the gut with every breath I take. Maybe the way that Lair is studying me, the way that the silver in her eyes catches the moonlight, is making me feel wild, fairy-charmed, enchanted. I surprise myself by leaning across the space between us. Again, I place my hand on Lair's thigh, but this time, we both know my gesture isn't one of comfort. I trace my fingertips lightly over the fabric of her pants, holding her gaze as her mouth opens, as she softly inhales. Her heat radiates into my palm, igniting something inside of me. Everything within me aches for Lair. She makes me feel wonder and excitement and raw, real desire. I can't deny this anymore. So impulsively, breathlessly, I brush my mouth against hers. As far as kisses go, it's light. Barely there, a question of a kiss. Do you want this too? My lips ask, their contact feather light. I want her to want it, and thank God she does. Lair wraps her arms around my shoulders, and the gear shift presses against my hip as our mouths crash together. I feel her sharp teeth on my lips, my tongue. Suddenly, I'm all heat, all longing. Lair's fingers curl into my hair. Her arms tighten around me, and we dedicate ourselves to this kiss. One kiss, single, hungry, endless. My hands cup her cheek, and then I trace her jaw, gliding my fingertips along the side of her warm neck. Her skin so soft, so hot. When we part hours, minutes, or seconds later, I'm panting. Lair's eyes are dark with desire as she gazes at me. She studies me for a moment, one brow raised, and then she flicks her flashing eyes toward her house. "Would you like to go inside and..." She begins, but her last word is clipped. She falls silent. She's staring at something, and, eyes wide, she closes her mouth, straightens her shoulders. I follow her gaze. No. No, no, no. And just like that, the memory of our kiss begins to fade, replaced by a sight that I can hardly make sense of. I blink at it as I sit in my seat, in shock, speechless, wringing my hands, shaking my head. Vandalism. On the front of Lair's house, the words, "I know what you did," are spray-painted in bright, jagged blue paint. Whoever did this stood brazen on Lair's lawn and scrawled the words in plain sight, where anyone might have seen, any neighbor, any passerby. Anyone could have seen, and someone probably did see, and no one stopped it from happening. No one stood up for Lair. "Oh my God," I whisper, as Lair and I reach for our door handles at the same time and climb out of the car, walking over to her driveway to stare at the ugly graffiti with our mouths hanging open. We're silent, dumbstruck. "I know what you did? What the hell could that mean?" Lair takes a deep breath and fists her hands on her hips, jaw set, her eyes solid mirrors beneath the glow of the street lamps. "Lair?" I thread my fingers through hers, squeezing her hand gently. She gazes at me with a distant, hollow gaze. It's all right. Don't trouble yourself, Courtney. This isn't a big deal, only a small one." Her voice is gruff. She sighs and rakes a hand through her long red hair. Suddenly, she looks weary, lifeless. Not at all like the vibrant, passionate woman who was kissing me in the car a moment ago. "I must call the police," she says, pulling her phone from the back pocket of her pants. "No," she pauses, narrowing her brows. "First I have to make certain Helly is okay, that they didn't break into the house." "I'll call the police, Lair. Don't worry about that. You go check on Van Helsing." She offers me a grateful half-smile, the most she can muster, I assume, at this point in time. "Thank you." I begin to dial the police station as Lair unlocks her front door, and I follow her inside with the phone pressed to my ear. She tries to wave me back, but I shake my head, doggedly persisting her. Because what if the vandal is still here? There's a slim chance that he or she would be stupid enough to stick around. But just in case, I don't want Lair to confront an intruder alone. My stomach twists as I listen to the phone ring. I think about the kidnappings from Give Life Technologies. I think about the people who hate vampires, who want them demeaned, punished, dead. I think about the fact that Lair isn't safe, and that I don't know how to protect her. "Hello?" I say, when a bored-sounding policeman picks up my call. "How can I help you, ma'am?" he drawls into the receiver, making wet, slurping sounds. He must be drinking something. Coffee, most likely, given the late hour. "What's going on?" His voice is young, sleepy. I stop, tongue-tied, uncertain as to what I should call Lair. "My friend Lair's house has just been vandalized," I say into the receiver, wincing. I take a deep breath, soldier on. "She's a vampire, and someone spray-painted the front of her house."
"Vampire, eh?"
the guy snorts. I grit my teeth, squeeze the phone, realizing too late that I shouldn't have mentioned the word vampire at all. "Look, her house has been vandalized. Could you send someone to..."
"Lady, we're real busy here tonight."
He makes a show of yawning loudly, and I can almost hear him rolling his eyes.
"We can get a squad car over there in the morning."
"The morning?" I blink, then glare at the phone for a moment, trying to suppress my anger. I'm standing in the lamplight of the living room. Lair has moved into the kitchen where I can hear her speaking softly to her dog. "But what if she's in danger? What if..." I swallow, wide-eyed, disbelieving. "Would you send a car out tonight if it were a human's house that had been vandalized?"
"I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Like I said, it's a busy night."
His tone is simpering. I think he's actually smiling.
"Just give me the details and we'll be out first thing in the a.m., okie dokie."
I answer his questions through clenched teeth and manage to keep my temper in check. But when I hang up the phone, the injustice, the absence of decency, of kindness, of empathy spikes my blood pressure sky high. My body is coursing with adrenaline from the vandalism, from the kiss. I grip my temples. This is all too much. "Look," I tell Lair, who's kneeling on the floor in her kitchen and gently massaging the area behind Van Helsing's ears. He's sitting before her with a dopey dog smile, thumping his tail against the tiled floor. "It isn't safe for you to stay here tonight." She regards me with haunted silver-blue eyes. I exhale heavily, dropping my phone back into my purse. Then I crouch down next to her and rest a hand on her shoulder. "Lair, something terrible could happen if you stay here. What if the vandal comes back? The police refuse to do anything until morning." I press my lips together, hard, breathing out through my nose.
"Because I'm a vampire, right?"
Her mouth curves softly, bitterly.
"That's why they won't come right now?"
I bow my head.
"I heard you on the phone," she says, with a small, sad smile. "I'm sorry. I should have warned you not to say anything about..."
She shakes her head, staring down at Helly with a forlorn expression. Her hair drifts from her shoulder, obscuring her face.
"The police in this city aren't disposed to serve and protect people like me."
My heart constricts in my chest, and I can feel tears gathering at the corners of my eyes.
"But that's so unfair. It's all right, Courtney,"
she tells me soothingly, wrapping her arms around me in a warm embrace. I hug her back, holding her tight against me.
"It's not all right. God, I'm so sorry. I wish there was something I could do."
My cheek against her shoulder, I take a deep breath, inhaling Lair's sweet perfume.
"Being here with me now is enough. More than enough,"
she whispers, pressing her lips to my forehead. We remain in that position for a long moment, tiredly supporting one another, reluctant to let go. The rhythm of her heartbeat calms me, and I find myself breathing easier, relaxing slightly. My head begins to clear.
"Please,"
I say then, hoarsely, sitting up and searching her face.
"Stay with me tonight. Not for any other reason than that I want to make certain you're safe,"
I finish weakly. I swallow the lump in my throat and await her answer.
After a moment's consideration, Lair nods. She looks drained, exhausted.
That's kind of you. Thank you, Courtney.
Good, it's settled. Come on, Helly, I tell the big dog, gathering his leash from the floor where it lay coiled. We walk quietly together through the living room. And then, after Lair locks her front door, the vampire, St. Bernard, and I make the short trek to my house. I rummage around in my drawers until I find my most comfortable pair of pajamas, the ones covered in sepia illustrations of books, and lend them to Lair, who considers them with a quiet, tired grace, a soft smile, and simply says, "Missy."
"Sure. You can head upstairs to the bathroom to change, freshen up."
"Okay." Lair nods and aims for the steps. To feel useful, I look after Van Helsing, setting him up in his own room, my guest bedroom. I fill a mixing bowl with water and carry it up the stairs, placing it beside him. He laps at it for a moment. Then he wags his tail, gazing up at me in adoration. I tug the comforter off of the bed and spread it out on the floor. He snuffles it appreciatively, pawing at its folds until he's satisfied by the messy configuration. Then he flops down with a sigh. The door is open, and Colette, who has never met a dog in her life, fluffs up to 10 times her normal size at the sight of our new, very large animal guest. Her tail is puffed out like a bottle brush, and the fur on her back is standing up in a straight line. And yet, despite the fact that she obviously loathes Van Helsing's presence, Colette dashes into the room and darts under the guest bed. Cat logic.
"Why?" I moan, crouching down to peer under the mattress.
"Colette, you crazy cat! You just ran into the same room as the animal you're terrified of," I remind her in soft, soothing tones. I've always believed that Colette understands human speech, but if she does possess that superpower, she isn't putting it to use now. Instead, she's yowling and staring at Van Helsing's paws, as if they're locked and loaded weapons of mass destruction. I sigh again, rising up to kneel and half-collapsing onto the bed. I'm too tired to deal with this. But if I don't get my panicked Colette out of this room, she's probably going to need therapy. And poor Helly will definitely need therapy.
"Is my boy giving you trouble?" asks Lair from the doorway.
"No, he's..." I glance over my shoulder and then sink down onto my heels, because my legs are far too weak to hold me up any longer. I swallow as my heart beats like a hammer in my chest. I suppose it's very French to undress in front of other people without shyness, as Lair demonstrated before the concert. It is probably, therefore, also very French to be nonchalant about buttoning up your button-up pajama top, because Lair hasn't buttoned the pajama shirt yet, revealing an inch-wide strip of rosy-tinged skin that looks warm and satin-soft. I lick my lips, blink a few times, and try to focus on the task at hand as Lair begins to button the shirt slowly, her fingers moving from the bottom up. She must have been in the middle of changing, heard Colette's banshee wails, and came out of the bathroom to see what she could do to help. Lair crosses the room and sinks down beside me on the floor, holding my gaze and leaning forward. I can't help but notice that she left the top 3 buttons undone. The pink swell of her breasts draws my eyes like gravity.
"Let's try to lure her out together, shall we?" says Lair.
Her lips curl up at the corners knowingly, as if she realizes where my eyes have trespassed. I draw in a deep breath and place my hand over hers.
"You're amazing."
She tilts her head, smile widening.
"How so?"
"If my house had been vandalized, I would be like Colette here, yowling under the bed, but you're calm, collected, brave." I trail off, gazing at her in wonder. Lair says nothing for a long moment, only studies me, her eyes flickering with something I can't read, her lips parted, her breath coming in a soft, steady rhythm that makes my heart forget how to beat.
"I am not brave, mon cher," she says quietly at last. "I only do what must be done. It's a skill I've learned, had to learn, over the years. But tonight I am in this house, your house, with you, and that makes up for a great deal of heartache."
I hold her gaze, unblinking, breathless. At this time, it's Lair who leans forward, who presses her mouth against mine, her lips hot and sweet. This kiss is softer than the one in the car, quieter, almost. Maybe because it's Lair who's taking the lead. Lair, who's moving her tongue against mine, who's kissing me with warmth and grace as I wrap my arms around her neck and press my body against hers. Still kissing, we rise instinctually, moving onto the guest bed, lying down on our sides in gradual motions face to face. Lair smiles against me, and her pointed incisors graze my bottom lip. I shudder against her. The teeth are sharp, but they trail over my skin like sheathed knives, incapable of harm, unwilling to commit harm. I know they could hurt me. They exist to bite. But I trust Lair wholly. Colette growls again under the bed, and it's only then that we draw apart, laughing together, sitting up. I chuckle, embarrassed, as Colette dashes out between my feet, disappearing through the open bedroom door and making a beeline for my room, and I imagine the sanctuary that awaits her under my bed. I sigh, rake a hand through my messy hair. Look, I tell Lair then, reaching out to tuck an errant red strand behind her ear. My fingers linger against her face, and she tilts her head to rest her cheek against my hand. It's been a long day for both of us, I whisper, smiling softly at her. Why don't we just go to bed? We'll talk in the morning, figure out what to do then about the house and everything else.
I would like that, Courtney,
Lair says, her voice a velvety purr of exhaustion. She smiles fondly at me. Then she takes up my hand and draws it up to her mouth, pressing a soft kiss against the center of my palm.
I would like that very much, she murmurs,
the growl in her voice making my skin shiver with goosebumps. Electricity zaps through my sleepy limbs, desire moving through me like a supercharged current. But I don't want our first time to be like this, exhausted, falling together to hush the unfairness of the world lurking outside of our embrace. I don't want to associate our first time with vandalism, with fear, with hate. So I do one of the hardest things I've ever done. I force myself to rise, to let her go. Until tomorrow, I tell her regretfully. Lair says nothing, but she watches me with her flickering gaze until I close the guest bedroom door behind me.
Chapter 8. You think you know someone. When I wake up, I'm sore all over, and my ears feel as if they're stuffed with cotton or like there's a white noise machine playing inside of my head. After a groggy moment, I realize that I slept in, that the sunshine filtering over the bedspread is a warm, golden, late-morning glow. I blink and peer at the clock. It's 10:15. I massage the back of my neck and stare up at the ceiling. Well, I must have needed the sleep. After all, it was a hell of a night. I remember Mia, angry at first and then sobbing, running away from me after we broke up. I remember the concert, the ear-blasting music, the throbbing bass, and Azure strutting across the stage as if the world belonged to her, because for an hour it kind of did. A rush of love and pride fills my chest. She was incredible, magnetic, my best friend, the rock star. I remember the vandalism, my fury toward the police officer and the bigoted world at large. Those words haunt me. I know what you did, sketched out in brilliant blue. I dreamed of that phrase last night, appearing everywhere I looked, on the walls, the windows, and the mirror streaked across my reflection. I shake my head, pushing the dream back into my subconscious, because the moments that I remember more clearly than anything else from last night are the kisses that I shared with Lair. I reach up, press my fingertips to my lips. They're sore too, but it's a delicious soreness, one that I hope lingers, reminding me of the taste of her mouth. God, I feel a little loopy, and a lot hot and bothered. Right, a cold shower is in order if I'm going to make it through the rest of the day. Flustered, I roll out of bed, wondering if Lair is still lying in my guest room, her coppery hair fanned over the pillow, or if, more likely, she woke up hours ago. Maybe she's not even in my house anymore. The policeman did tell me that he'd send a car over in the morning to check out the scene of the crime. I shuffle out of the bedroom, nearly tripping over Colette, and stumble across the hallway toward the bathroom. I tap the halfway open door absentmindedly, and Lair's standing there, wringing her hair out in a towel. She's very nude,